to the lands of the first men in Westeros. The Valyrians had denied the Andals the promise of the Seven on Essos, but in Westeros they were free. Made zealous by the conflict and flight, the warriors of the Andals carved a seven-pointed star upon their bodies and swore by their blood and the Seven not to rest until they had hewn their kingdoms from the Sunset Lands. This success gave Westeros a new name, Rhaesh An'dali, the land of the Andals, as the Dothraki now name it. It's agreed by the Septons, the Singers, and the Maesters alike that the first place where the Andals landed was on the Fingers in the Vale of Arryn. Carvings of the seven-pointed star are scattered upon the rocks and stones throughout that area, a practice that eventually fell out of use as the Andal conquest progressed. Sweeping through the Vale with fire and sword, the Andals began their conquest of Westeros. Their iron weapons and armor surpassed the bronze with which the first men still fought, and many first men perished in this war. It was a war, or a series of many wars, which likely lasted for decades. Eventually, some of the first men submitted, and, as I noted earlier, there are still houses in the Vale who proudly proclaim their descent from the first men, such as the Red Forts and the Royces. The Singers say that the Andal hero, Sir Artes Eren, rode upon a falcon to slay the Griffin King upon the giant's lance, thereby founding the kingly line of House Eren. This is foolishness, however, a corruption of the true history of the Erens with legends out of the Age of Heroes. Instead, the Eren kings supplanted the High Kings of House Royce. When the Vale was secured, the Andals turned their attention to the rest of Westeros and poured forth through the Bloody Gate. In the wars that followed, Andal adventurers carved out small kingdoms from the old realms of the First Men and fought one another as often as they fought their enemies. In the wars over the Trident, it is said that as many as seven Andal kings joined forces against the last true king of the rivers and hills, Christopher the Fourth, who was descended from the First Men, and defeated him in what the Singers claim was his 100th battle. Isaiah, Christopher the Fifth, proved unable to defend his father's legacy, and so the kingdom fell to the Andals. In the same era, one Andal, remembered in legend as Ereg the Kinslayer, came across the great hill of High Heart. There, while under the protection of the kings of the First Men, the children of the forest had tended to the mighty carved weirwoods that crowned it. 31, according to Archmaester Laurent in his manuscript, Old Places of the Trident. When Ereg's warriors sought to cut down the trees, the first men are said to have fought beside the children, but the might of the Andals was too great. Though the children and first men made a valiant effort to defend their holy grove, all were slain. The tale-tellers now claim that the ghosts of the children still haunt the hill by night. To this day, rivermen shun the place. As with the first men before them, the Andals proved bitter enemies to the remaining children. To their eyes, the children worshipped strange gods and had strange customs, and so the Andals drove them out of all the deep woods the pact had once given them. Weakened and grown insular over the years, the children lacked whatever advantages they had once had over the first men, and what the first men could never succeed in doing, eradicating the children entirely, the Andals managed to achieve in short order. Some few children may have fled to the Neck, where there was safety amidst the bogs and crannogs, but if they did, no trace of them remains. It is possible that a few survived on the Isle of Faces, as some have written, under the protection of the Green Men, whom the Andals never succeeded in destroying, but again no definitive proof has ever been found.
The clans of the Mountains of the Moon are clearly descendants of the first men who did not bend the knee to the Andals and so were driven into the mountains. Furthermore, there are similarities in their customs to the customs of the wildlings beyond the wall, such as bride-stealing, a stubborn desire to rule themselves and the like, and the wildlings are indisputably descended from the first men.
Regardless, the few children remaining fled or died, and the first men found themselves losing war after war and kingdom after kingdom to the Andal invaders. The battles and wars were endless, but eventually all the southern kingdoms fell. As with the Vale men, some submitted to the Andals, even taking up the faith of the Seven. In many cases, the Andals took the wives and daughters of the defeated kings to wife, as a means of solidifying their right to rule. For despite everything, the first men were far more numerous than the Andals, and could not simply be forced aside. The fact that many southern castles still have God's woods with carved weirwoods at their hearts is said to be thanks to the early Andal kings, who shifted from conquest to consolidation, thus avoiding any conflict based on differing faiths. Even the Arnborn, the fierce sea-roving warriors, who must have at first thought themselves safe upon their isles, fell to the wave of Andal conquests. For though it took 1,000 years for the Andals to turn their attention to the Arn Islands, when they did so with renewed zeal. The Andals swept over the islands, extinguishing the line of Arran Redhand, which had ruled by axe and sword for 1,000 years. Hereg writes that at first the new Andal kings sought to force worship of the Seven on the Ironborn, but the Ironborn would not have it. Instead, they allowed it to coexist with their worship of the Drawn God. As on the mainland, the Andals married the wives and daughters of the Ironborn and had children by them. But unlike on the mainland, the faith never took root. More, it did not hold firm even among the families of Andal blood. In time, only the Drawn God came to rule over the Arn Islands, with only a few houses remembering the Seven. It was the North, and the North alone, that was able to keep the Andals at bay, thanks to the impenetrable swamps of the Neck and the ancient keep of Moat Cailin. The number of Andal armies that were destroyed in the Neck cannot be easily reckoned, and so the Kings of Winter preserve their independent rule for many centuries to come. 10,000 ships. The last of the great migrations into Westeros happened long after the coming of the first men and the Andals. Once the Gascari Wars had ended, the Dragon Lords of Valyria turned their gaze toward the west, where the growth of Valyrian power brought the Freehold and its colonies into conflict with the peoples of the Rhoyn. The mightiest river in the world, the Rhoyn's many tributaries, stretched across much of western Essos. Along their banks had arisen a civilization and culture as storied and ancient as the old empire of Gis. The Rhoynar had grown rich off the bounty of their river. Mother Rhoyn, they named her. Fishers, traders, teachers, scholars, workers in wood and stone and metal, they raised their elegant towns and cities from the headwaters of the Rhoyn down to her mouth, each lovelier than the last. There was Goyen Dro in the Velvet Hills, with its groves and waterfalls, Nysar, the city of fountains, alive with song, Arnoy on the Coin, with its halls of green marble, pale Sarmel of the flowers, See Girt, Sahoy, with its canals and salt water gardens, and Croyen, greatest of all, the festival city with its great palace of love. Art and music flourished in the cities of the Rhône, and it is said their people had their own magic, a water magic very different from the sorceries of Valyria, which were woven of blood and fire. Though united by blood and culture and the river that had given them birth, the Rhônish cities were elsewise fiercely independent, each with its own prince or princess, for amongst these river folk, women were regarded as the equals of men. By and large, a peaceful people, the Rhônar could be formidable when roused to wrath, as many a would-be Andal conqueror learned to his sorrow. The Rhônish warrior, with his silver-scaled armour, fish-haired helm, tall spear, and turtle-shell shield, was esteemed and feared by all those who faced him in battle. It was said, the mother Rhône herself whispered to her children of every threat that the Rhônar princes wielded strange, uncanny powers, that Rhônish women fought as fiercely as Rhônish men, and that their cities were protected by watery walls that would rise to drown any foe. For many centuries the Rhônar lived in peace, though many a savage people dwelt in the hills and forests around Mother Rhône. All knew better than to molest the river folk, and the Rhônar themselves showed little interest in expansion. The river was their home, their mother, and their god, and few of them wished to dwell beyond the sound of her eternal song. When adventurers, exiles, and traders from the freehold of Valyria began to expand beyond the lands of the Long Sommer in the centuries after the fall of the old empire of Gis, the Rhônish princes embraced them at first, and their priests declared that all men were welcome to share the bounty of Mother Rhône. As those first Valyrian outposts grew into towns, and those towns into cities, however, some Rhônar came to regret the forbearance of their fathers. Amity gave way to enmity, particularly upon the lower river where the ancient city of Saar Mell and the walled Valyrian town Volantheris faced each other across the waters and on the shores of the Sommer Sea, where the free city of Valantis soon rivaled the storied port of Sahoy, each of them commanding one of Mother Rhône's four mouths. Disputes between the citizens of the rival cities became ever more common and ever more rancorous, finally giving birth to a series of short but bloody wars. Saar Mell and Volantheris were the first cities to meet in battle. Legend claims that the clash began when the Valyrians netted and butchered one of the gigantic turtles the Rhônar called the Old Men of the River and held sacred as the consorts of Mother Rhône herself. The first turtle war lasted less than a moon's turn. Saar Mell was raided and burned, yet it emerged victorious when Rhônish water wizards called up the power of the river and flooded Volantheris. Half the city was washed away, if the tales can be believed. Other wars followed, however. The War of Three Princes, the Second Turtle War, the Fisherman's War, the Salt War, the Third Turtle War, the War on Dagger Lake, the Spice War, and many more too numerous to recount here. Cities and towns were burned, drowned, and rebuilt. Thousands were killed or enslaved. In these conflicts, the Valyrians emerged as victors more often than not. The princes of the Rhône, fiercely proud of their independence, fought alone, whilst the Valyrian colonies aided one another, and when hard-pressed, called upon the power of the freehold itself. Beldekar's History of the Rhônish Wars is without equal in describing these conflicts, which stretched over the best part of 2.5 centuries. This series of conflicts reached a bloody climax 1,000 years ago in the Second Spice War, when 3 Valyrian dragon lords joined with their kin and cousins in Volantis to overwhelm, sack, and destroy Sarhoy, the great Ruinar port city upon the summer sea. The warriors of Sarhoy were slaughtered savagely, their children carried off into slavery, and their proud pink city put to the torch. Afterward, the Volantines sowed the smoking ruins with salt, so that Sarhoy might never rise again. The utter destruction of one of the richest and most beautiful of the cities of the Rhoyne, and the enslavement of her people, shocked and dismayed the remaining Ruinar princes. "We shall all be slaves unless we join together to end this threat," declared the greatest of them, Garin of Coriaine. This warrior prince called upon his fellows to join with him in a great alliance to wash away every Valyrian city on the river. Only Princess Nymeria of Nysar spoke against him. "This is a war we cannot hope to win," she warned. But the other princes shouted her down and pledged their swords to Garin. Even the warriors of her own Nysar were eager to fight, and Nymeria had no choice but to join the Great Alliance. The largest army that Essos had ever seen soon assembled at Coriaine, under the command of Prince Garin. According to Beldacar, it was 250,000 strong. From the headwaters of the Rhoyne down to her many mouths, every man of fighting age took up sword and shield and made his way to the festival city to join this great campaign. "So long as the army remained beside Mother Rhoyne," the prince declared, "they need not fear the dragons of Valyria. Their own water wizards would protect them against the fires of the freehold." Garin divided his enormous host into 3 parts. One marched down the east bank of the Rhoyne, one along the west, whilst a huge fleet of war galleys kept pace on the waters between, sweeping the river clean of enemy ships. From Croyane, Prince Garin led his gathered might downriver, destroying every village, town, and outpost in his path, and smashing all opposition. At Selhoris, he won his first battle, overwhelming a Valyrian army 30,000 strong, and taking the city by storm. Barasar met the same fate. At Volantheris, Garin found himself facing 100,000 foes, 100 war elephants, and 3 dragon lords. Here, too, he prevailed, though at great cost. Thousands burned, but thousands more sheltered in the shallows of the river, whilst their wizards raised enormous water spouts against the foe's dragons. Rhoynish archers brought down 2 of the dragons, whilst the 3rd fled, wounded. In the aftermath, Mother Rhoyne rose in rage to swallow Volantheris. Thereafter men began to name the victorious prince Garin the Great, and it is said that in Volantis great lords trembled in terror as his host advanced. Rather than face him in the field, the Volantines retreated back behind their black walls and appealed to the freehold for help. And the dragons came. Not 3, as Prince Garin had faced at Volantheris, but 300 or more, if the tales that have come down to us can be believed. Against their fires, the Ruinar could not stand. Tens of thousands burned, whilst others rushed into the river, hoping that the embrace of Mother Rhoyne would offer them protection against dragon flame, only to drown in their mother's embrace. Some chroniclers insist that the fires burned so hot that the very waters of the river boiled and turned to steam. Garin the Great was captured alive and made to watch his people suffer for their defiance. His warriors were shown no such mercy. The Volantines and their Valyrian kin put them to the sword, so many that it was said that their blood turned the great harbour of Valantis red as far as the eye could see. Thereafter the victors gathered their own forces and moved north along the river, sacking Sarmel savagely before advancing on Croyaine, Prince Garin's own city. Locked in a golden cage at the command of the Dragon Lords, Garin was carried back to the festival city to witness its destruction. At Croyaine, the cage was hung from the walls so that the prince might witness the enslavement of the women and children whose fathers and brothers had died in his gallant, hopeless war. But the prince, it is said, called down a curse upon the conquerors, entreating Mother Royne to avenge her children. And so, that very night, the Royne flooded out of season, and with greater force than was known in living memory. A thick fog, full of evil humours, fell, and the Valyrian conquerors began to die of greyscale. There is at least this much truth to the tale. In later centuries, Lomas Longstrider wrote of the drowned ruins of Croyaine, its foul fogs and waters, and the fact that wayward travellers, infected with greyscale, now haunt the ruins, a hazard for those who travel the river beneath the broken span of the Bridge of Dream. Higher on the Rhône, in Nysar, Princess Nymeria soon received the news of Garin's shattering defeat and the enslavement of the people of Croyaine and Sarmel. The same fate awaited her own city, she saw. Accordingly, she gathered every ship that remained upon the Rhône, large or small, and filled them full of as many women and children as they could carry, for almost all the men of fighting age had marched with Garin and died. Down the river, Nymeria led this ragged fleet, past ruined and smoking towns and fields of the dead, through waters choked with bloated, floating corpses. To avoid Volantis and its hosts, she chose the older channel and emerged into the summer sea where once Sahoy had stood. Legend tells us that Nymeria took 10,000 ships to sea, searching for a new home for her people beyond the long reach of Valyria and its dragon lords. Beldekar argues that this number was vastly inflated, perhaps as much as tenfold. Other chroniclers offer other numbers. But in truth, no true count was ever made. We can safely say there were a great many ships. Most were river craft, skiffs and pole boats, trading galleys, fishing boats, pleasure barges, even rafts, their decks and holds crammed full of women and children and old men. Only 1 in 10 was remotely seaworthy, Beldekar insists. Nymeria's voyage was long and terrible. More than 100 ships foundered and sank in the first storm her fleet encountered. As many or more turned back in fear and were taken by slavers out of Volantis. Others fell behind or drifted away, never to be seen again. The remainder of the fleet limped across the summer sea to the Basilisk Isles, where they paused to take on fresh water and provisions, only to fall afoul of the Corsair kings of Axile, Talon, and the Howling Mountain, who put aside their own quarrels long enough to descend upon the Rhoynar with fire and sword, putting 20 ships to the torch and carrying off hundreds into slavery. In the aftermath, the Corsairs offered to allow the Rhoynar to settle upon the Isle of Toads, provided they gave up their boats and sent each king 30 virgin girls and pretty boys each year as tribute. Nymeria refused and took a fleet to sea once again, hoping to find refuge amongst the steaming jungles of Sothorius. Some settled on Basilisk Point, others beside the glistening green waters of the Samoyas, amongst quicksands, crocodiles, and rotting half-drowned trees. Princess Nymeria herself remained with the ships at Zamatar, a Gascari colony, abandoned for 1,000 years, whilst others made their way upriver to the Cyclopean ruins of Yin, haunt of ghouls and spiders. There were riches to be found in Sothorius, gold, gems, rare woods, exotic pelts, queer fruits, and strange spices. But the Roynar did not thrive there. The sullen, wet heat oppressed their spirits, and swarms of stinging flies spread one disease after another. Green fever, the dancing plague, blood boils, weeping sores, sweet rot. The young and very old proved especially vulnerable to such contagions. Even to splash in the river was to court death, for the Samoyas was infested with schools of carnivorous fish and tiny worms that laid their eggs in the flesh of swimmers. Two of the new towns on Basilisk Point were raided by slavers, their populaces put to the sword or carried off in chains, whilst Yin had to contend with attacks from the brindled ghouls of the jungle deeps. For more than a year, the Roynar struggled to survive in Sothorius until the day when a boat from Zamatar arrived at Yin to find that every man, woman, and child in that haunted, ruined city had vanished overnight. Then Nymeria summoned her people back to the ships and set sail once again. For the next 3 years, the Roynar wandered the southern seas, seeking a new home. On Naith, the Isle of Butterflies, the peaceful people gave them welcome. But the god that protects that strange land began to strike down the newcomers by the score with a nameless mortal illness, driving them back to their ships. In the summer isles, they settled on an uninhabited rock off the eastern shore of Wanano, which soon became known as the Isle of Women, but its thin, stony soil yielded little food, and many starved. When the sails were raised again, some of the Roynar abandoned Nymeria to follow a priestess named Druselka, who claimed to have heard Mother Royn calling her children home. But when Druselka and her followers returned to their old cities, they found their enemies waiting, and most were soon hunted down, slain, or enslaved. The battered, tattered remainder of the 10,000 ships sailed west with Princess Nymeria. This time she made for Westeros. After so much wandering, her ships were even less seaworthy than when they had first departed Mother Royn. The fleet did not arrive in dawn complete. Even now there are isolated pockets of Roynar on the stepstones, claiming descent from those who were shipwrecked. Other ships, blown off course by storms, made for Lys or Tyrosh, giving themselves up to slavery in preference to a watery grave. The remaining ships made landfall on the coast of Dorne, near the mouth of the River Greenblood, not far from the ancient sandstone walls of the sandship Seat of House Martell. Dry, desolate, and thinly peopled, Dorne at this time was a poor land where a score of quarrelsome lords and petty kings warred endlessly over every river, stream, well, and scrap of fertile land. Most of these Dornish lords viewed the Roynar as unwelcome interlopers, invaders, with queer foreign ways and strange gods, who should be driven back into the sea whence they'd come. But Mors Martell, the lord of the sandship, saw in the newcomers an opportunity, and, if the singers can be believed, his lordship also lost his heart to Nymeria, the fierce and beautiful warrior queen who had led her people across the world to keep them free. It is said that amongst the Roynar who came to Dorne with Nymeria, 8 of every 10 were women. but a quarter of those were warriors in the Roynish tradition, and even those who did not fight had been hardened during their travels and travails. As well, thousands who had been boys when fleeing the Royne had grown into manhood and taken up the spear during their years of wandering. By joining with the newcomers, the Martells increased the size of their host by tenfold. When Mors Martell took Nymeria to wife, hundreds of his knights, squires, and lords bannermen also wed Roynish women, and many of those who were already wed took them for their paramours. Thus were the two peoples united by blood. These unions enriched and strengthened House Martell and its Dornish allies. The Roynar brought considerable wealth with them. Their artisans, metalworkers, and stonemasons brought skills far in advance of those achieved by their Westerosi counterparts, and their armourers were soon producing swords and spears and suits of scale and plate no Westerosi smith could hope to match. Even more crucially, it is said, the Roynish water witches knew secret spells that made dry streams flow again and deserts bloom. To celebrate these unions and make certain her people could not again retreat to the sea, Nymeria burned the Roynish ships. "Our wanderings are at an end," she declared. "We have found a new home, and here we shall live and die." Some of the Roynar mourned the loss of the ships, and rather than embracing their new land, they took to plying the waters of the Greenblood, finding it a pale shadow of Mother Roynne, whom they continued to worship. They still exist to this day, known as the Orphans of the Greenblood. The flames lit the coast for 50 leagues as hundreds of leaking, listing hulks were put to the torch and turned to ash. In the light of their burning, Princess Nymeria named Mors Martell the Prince of Dawn in the Roynish style, asserting his dominion over the red sands and the white and all the lands and rivers from the mountains to the great salt sea. Such supremacy was easier to declare than to achieve, however. Years of war followed, as the Martells and their Roynar partners met and subdued one petty king after another. No fewer than 6 conquered kings were sent to the wall in golden fetters by Nymeria and her prince, until only the greatest of their foes remained. Yorick Ironwood, the Blood Royal, 5th of his name, Lord of Ironwood, Warden of the Stoneway, Knight of the Wells, King of Redmarch, King of the Greenbelt, and King of the Dornish. For 9 years, Mors Martell and his allies, amongst them House Farla of Skyreach, House Toland of Ghost Hill, House Dane of Starfall, and House Ulla of the Hellholt, struggled against Ironwood and his bannermen. The Jourdanes of the Tor, the Wills of the Stone Way, together with the Blackmonts, the Corgyles, and many more, in battles too numerous to mention. When Mors Martell fell to Yorick Ironwood's sword in the 3rd Battle of the Boneway, Princess Nymeria assumed sole command of his armies. 2 more years of battle were required, but in the end it was Nymeria that Yorick Ironwood bent the knee to, and Nymeria who ruled thereafter from Sunspear. Though she married twice more, first to the aged Lord Ulla of Hellholt, and later to the dashing Sir Davos Dane of Starfall, the Sword of the Morning, Nymeria herself remained the unquestioned ruler of Dawn for almost 27 years, her husband serving only as counsellors and consorts. She survived a 12 attempts upon her life, put down 2 rebellions, and threw back 2 invasions by the Storm King Durin III, and one by King Graydon of the Reach. When at last she died, It was the eldest of her four daughters, by Mors Martell, who succeeded her. Not her son, by Davos Dane. For by then the Dornish had come to adopt many of the laws and customs of the Rhoynar, though the memories of Mother Rhoyn and the 10,000 ships were fading into legend. The Doom of Valyria. With the destruction of the Rhoynar, Valyria soon achieved complete domination of the western half of Essos, from the Narrow Sea to Slaver's Bay, and from the Summer Sea to the Shivering Sea. Slaves poured into the freehold and were quickly dispatched beneath the 14 flames to mine the precious gold and silver the freeholders loved so well. Perhaps in preparation for their crossing of the Narrow Sea, the Valyrians also established their westernmost outpost on the isle that would come to be known as Dragonstone, some 200 years before the Doom. No king opposed them, and though the local lords of the Narrow Sea made some effort to resist it, the strength of Valyria was too great. With their arcane arts, the Valyrians raised the citadel at Dragonstone. 2 centuries passed, centuries in which the coveted Valyrian steel began to trickle into the Seven Kingdoms more swiftly than before, though not swiftly enough for all the lords and kings who desired it. And although the sight of a dragon lord flying high above Blackwater Bay was not unknown, it occurred more frequently as time passed. Valyria felt its outposts were secured, and the dragon lords thus continued their schemes and intrigues on their native continent. And then, unexpected to all, save perhaps Aenar Targaryen and his maiden daughter, Daenerys the Dreamer, the doom came to Valyria. To this day, no one knows what caused the doom. Most say that it was a natural cataclysm, a catastrophic explosion caused by the eruption of all 14 flames together. Some septons, less wise, claim that the Valyrians brought the disaster on themselves for their promiscuous belief in 100 gods and more. And in their godlessness, they delved too deep and unleashed the fires of the 7 hells on the freehold. A handful of maesters, influenced by fragments of the work of Septon Barth, held that Valyria had used spells to tame the 14 flames for thousands of years, that their ceaseless hunger for slaves and wealth was as much to sustain these spells as to expand their power, and that when at last those spells faltered, the cataclysm became inevitable. Of these some argue that it was the curse of Garen the Great at last coming to fruition. Others speak of the priests of R'hllor calling down the fire of their god in queer rituals. Some, wedding the fanciful notion of Valyrian magic to the reality of the ambitious great houses of Valyria, have argued that it was the constant whirl of conflict and deception amongst the great houses that might have led to the assassinations of too many of the reputed mages who renewed and maintained the rituals that banked the fires of the 14 flames. The one thing that can be said for certain is that it was a cataclysm such as the world had never seen. The ancient mighty freehold, home to dragons and to sorcerers of unrivaled skill, was shattered and destroyed within hours. It was written that every hill for 500 miles split asunder to fill the air with ash and smoke and fire so hot and hungry that even the dragons in the sky were engulfed and consumed. Great rents opened in the earth, swallowing palaces, temples, and entire towns. Lakes boiled or turned to acid. Mountains burst. Fiery fountains spewed molten rock 1,000 feet into the air. and red clouds rained down dragon glass and the black blood of demons. To the north the ground splintered and collapsed and fell in on itself, and an angry sea came boiling in. The proudest city in all the world was gone in an instant. The fabled empire vanished in a day. The lands of the long summer, once the most fertile in all the world, were scorched and drowned and blighted, and the toll in blood would not be fully realized for a century to come. What followed in the sudden vacuum was chaos. The dragon lords had been gathered in Valyria, as was their wont, except for Aenar Targaryen, his children, and his dragons, who had fled to Dragonstone and so escaped the doom. Some accounts claim that a few others survived too, for a time. It is said that some Valyrian dragon lords in Tyrosh and Lys were spared, but that in the immediate political upheaval following the doom, they and their dragons were killed by the citizens of those free cities. The histories of Kohor likewise claim that a visiting dragon lord, Arian, raised forces from the Kohoric colonists and proclaimed himself the first emperor of Valyria. He flew away on the back of his great dragon, with 30,000 men following behind afoot, to lay claim to what remained of Valyria and to re-establish the freehold. But neither Emperor Arian nor his host were ever seen again. The time of the dragons in Essos was at an end. Volantis, the mightiest of the free cities, quickly laid claim to Valyria's mantle. Men and women of noble Valyrian blood, though not dragon lords, called for war upon the other cities. The Tigers, as those who advocated conquest came to be known, led Volantis into a great conflict with the other free cities. They had great success at first, their fleets and armies controlling Lys and Myr, and commanding the southern reaches of the Rhône. It was only when they overreached and attempted to seize Tyrosh as well that their burgeoning empire collapsed. Unnerved by the Volantine aggression, Pentos joined the Tyroshi in resistance. Myr and Lys rebelled, and the Sea Lord of Braavos provided a fleet of 100 ships to aid Lys. Also, the Westerosi Storm King, Argilac the Arrogant, led a host into the disputed lands in return for the promise of gold and glory that defeated a Volantine host attempting to retake Myr.
In the wake of all the conflicts and the struggles that continue to this day over the disputed lands, the plague of the free companies was born and took root. At first, these bands of sellswords merely fought for whoever paid them. But there are those who say that, whenever peace threatened, the captains of these free companies acted to instigate new wars to sustain themselves, and so grew fat on the spoils.
Near the end, even the future conqueror, the still young Aegon Targaryen, became involved in the struggle. His ancestors had long looked east, but his attention from an early age had been turned westward. Still, when Pentos and Tyrosh approached him, inviting him to join a grand alliance against Volantis, he listened, and for reasons unknown to this day, he chose to heed their call, to a point. Mounting the Black Dread, it is said that he flew to the east, meeting with the Prince of Pentos and the Magisters of the Free City, and from there flew Balerion to Lys, in time to set ablaze a Volantine fleet that was preparing to invade that free city. Volantis suffered further defeats at Dagger Lake, when the fire galleys of Kohor and Novus destroyed much of the Volantine fleet that controlled the Rhône. And in the east, when the Dothraki began to swarm out of the Dothraki Sea, leaving ruined towns and cities in their wake, as they fell on the weakened Volantis. At last, the Elephants, the Volantine faction who favoured peace and who were largely drawn from the wealthy tradesmen and merchants who suffered most in the war, took power from the Tigers, who favoured conquest, and put an end to the fighting. As for Aegon Targaryen, shortly after his role in defeating Volantis, it is written that he lost all interest in the affairs of the East. Believing Volantis's rule at an end, he flew back to Dragonstone, and now, no longer distracted by the wars of Essos, he turned his gaze west.
The freehold of Valyria and its empire were destroyed by the Doom, but the shattered peninsula remains. Strange tales are told of it today, and of the demons that haunt the smoking sea where the 14 flames once stood. In fact, the road that joins Volantis to Slaver's Bay has become known as the Demon Road, and is best avoided by all sensible travellers. And men who have dared the smoking sea do not return, as Volantis learned during the Century of Blood, when a fleet it sent to claim the peninsula vanished. There are queer rumours of men living still among the ruins of Valyria and its neighbouring cities of Oros and Tyria. Yet others dispute this, saying that the Doom still holds Valyria in its grip. A few of the cities away from the heart of Valyria remain inhabited, however, places founded by the Freehold, or subject to it. The most sinister of these is Mantaris, a place where the men are said to be born twisted and monstrous. Some attribute this to the city's presence on the Demon Road. The reputations of Tolos, where the finest slingers in the world can be found, and of the city of Illyria on its isle, are less sinister, and less noteworthy as well. For they have made ties to the Giscari cities on Slaver's Bay, and otherwise avoid involvement in any efforts to reclaim the burning heart of Valyria.
The Reign of the Dragons. Here follows an account of the reign of the House Targaryen from Aegon the Conqueror to Aerys the Mad King. Many are the maesters who have written on these matters, and the knowledge they have fashioned informs much of what will follow. But in one thing I have taken liberty. The account of Aegon's conquest is not my own work, but something lately discovered in the archives of the Citadel, forgotten since the sad end of Aegon, the fifth of his name. This fragment, part of a greater work that seemed intended as a history of the Targaryen kings, was found gathering dust among papers belonging to the Archmaester Gerald, the historian whose writings on the history of Oldtown were well regarded in his day. But it was not written by him. The style alone gives it away. But certain notes found with these papers indicate they were written by Archmaester Gildane, the last maester to serve at Summerhall before its destruction in the reign of Aegon the Fortunate, the fifth of his name, who may have sent them to Gerald for his commentary and approval. The history of the conquest is as complete as any, and that is why I have placed it here, so that at last more eyes than mine and the late Archmaester Gerald's may appreciate and learn from it. There are other manuscripts by the same hand that I have discovered, but many pages have been misplaced or destroyed, and still others have been damaged by neglect and by fire. It may be that one day more will be found, and this lost masterwork will be fit to be copied and bound, for what I have found has stirred great excitement in the Citadel. Until then, however, its fragments serve as one of many sources for the reigns of the Targaryen kings, from their conqueror to the late Ares II, the last Targaryen king to sit the Iron Throne. The Conquest. The maesters of the Citadel, who keep the histories of Westeros, have used Aegon's conquest as their touchstone for the past 300 years. Births, deaths, battles, and other events are dated either AC, after the conquest, or BC, before the conquest. True scholars know that such dating is far from precise. Aegon Targaryen's conquest of the Seven Kingdoms did not take place in a single day. More than 2 years passed between Aegon's landing and his old town coronation. And even then the conquest remained incomplete, since Dorne remained unsubdued. Sporadic attempts to bring the Dornishmen into the realm continued all through King Aegon's reign, and well into the reigns of his sons, making it impossible to fix a precise end date for the wars of conquest. Even the start date is a matter of some misconception. Many assume wrongly that the reign of King Aegon I Targaryen began on the day he landed at the mouth of the Blackwater Rush, beneath the three hills where the city of King's Landing eventually stood. Not so. The day of Aegon's landing was celebrated by the king and his descendants, but the conqueror actually dated the start of his reign from the day he was crowned and anointed in the starry sept of Oldtown by the High Septon of the Faith. This coronation took place 2 years after Aegon's landing, well after all three of the major battles of the Wars of Conquest had been fought and won. Thus it can be seen that most of Aegon's actual conquering took place from 2 to 1 BC, before the conquest. The Targaryens were of pure Valyrian blood, dragon lords of ancient lineage. 12 years before the doom of Valyria, 114 BC, Aenar Targaryen sold his holdings in the Freehold and the lands of the Long Summer, and moved with all his wives, wealth, slaves, dragons, siblings, kin, and children to Dragonstone, a bleak island citadel beneath a smoking mountain in the narrow sea. At its apex, Valyria was the greater city in the known world, the center of civilization. Within its shining walls, 20 rival houses vied for power and glory, in court and council, rising and falling in an endless, subtle, off-savage struggle for dominance. The Targaryens were far from the most powerful of the Dragon Lords, and their rivals saw their flight to Dragonstone as an act of surrender, as cowardice. But Lord Aenar's maiden daughter Daenerys, known forever afterward as Daenerys the Dreamer, had foreseen the destruction of Valyria by fire. And when the doom came 12 years later, the Targaryens were the only Dragon Lords to survive. Dragonstone had been the westernmost outpost of Valyria power for 2 centuries. Its location athwart the gullet gave its lords a stranglehold on Blackwater Bay, and enabled both the Targaryens and their close allies, the Valyrians of Driftmark, a lesser house of Valyrian descent, to fill their coffers of the passing trade. Valyrian ships, along with those of another allied Valyrian house, the Celtigars of Claw Isle, dominated the middle reaches of the narrow sea, whilst the Targaryens ruled the skies with their dragons. Yet even so, for the best part of 100 years after the doom of Valyria, the rightly named Century of Blood, House Targaryen looked east, not west, and took little interest in the affairs of Westeros. Gaemon Targaryen, brother and husband to Daenerys the Dreamer, followed Aenar the Exile as Lord of Dragonstone and became known as Gaemon the Glorious. Gaemon's son, Aegon, and his daughter, Elaena, ruled together after his death. After them, the lordship passed to their son, Maegon. His brother Ares, and Ares' sons, Aelix, Balon, and Damien. The last of the three brothers was Damien, whose son, Arion, then succeeded to Dragonstone. The Aegon who is known to history as Aegon the Conqueror and Aegon the Dragon was born on Dragonstone in 27 BC. He was the only son and second child of Arion, Lord of Dragonstone, and Lady Velena of House Velaryon, herself half Targaryen on her mother's side. Aegon had two true-born siblings, an elder sister, Visenya, and a younger sister, Rhaenys. It had long been the custom amongst the dragon lords of Valyria to wed brother to sister, to keep the bloodlines pure. But Aegon took both his sisters to bride. By tradition, he was expected to wed only his older sister, Visenya. The inclusion of Rhaenys as a second wife was unusual, though not without precedent. It was said by some that Aegon wed Visenya out of duty and Rhaenys out of desire. All three siblings had shown themselves to be dragon lords before they wed. Of the five dragons who had flown with Aenor the exile from Valyria, only one survived to Aegon's day, the great beast called Balerion, the Black Dread. The remaining two dragons, Vhagar and Meraxes, were younger, hatched on Dragonstone itself. A common myth, oft heard among the ignorant, claims that Aegon Targaryen had never set foot upon the soil of Westeros until the day he set sail to conquer it. But this cannot be true. Years before that voyage, the painted table had been carved and decorated at Lord Aegon's command, a massive slab of wood, some 50 feet long, carved in the shape of Westeros and painted to show all the woods and rivers and towns and castles of the Seven Kingdoms. Plainly, Aegon's interest in Westeros long predated the events that drove him to war. As well, there are reliable reports of Aegon and his sister Visenya visiting the citadel of Old Town in their youth, and hawking on the arbor as guests of Lord Redwine. He may have visited Lannisport as well. Accounts differ. The Westeros of Aegon's youth was divided into seven quarrelsome kingdoms, and there was hardly a time when two or three of these kingdoms were not at war with one another. The vast, cold, stony north was ruled by the Starks of Winterfell. In the deserts of Dorne, the Martell princes held sway. The gold-rich Westerlands were ruled by the Lannisters of Casterly Rock, the Fertile Reach by the Gardeners of High Garden. The Vale, the Fingers, and the Mountains of the Moon belonged to House Aeron. But the most belligerent kings of Aegon's time were the two whose realms lay closest to Dragonstone, Haeron the Black and Argilac the Arrogant. From their great citadel Storm's End, the Storm Kings of House Darrendon had once ruled the eastern half of Westeros from Cape Wrath to the Bay of Crabs. But their powers had been dwindling for centuries. The Kings of the Reach had nibbled at their domains from the west, the Dornishmen harassed them from the south, and Harren the Black and his Iron Men had pushed them from the Trident and the lands north of the Blackwater Rush. King Argilac, last of the Darrendon, had arrested this decline for a time, turning back a Dornish invasion while still a boy, crossing the narrow sea to join the Great Alliance against the imperialist Tigers of Volantis, and slaying Garth the Seventh Gardener, King of the Reach, in the Battle of Summerfield 20 years later. But Argilac had grown older. His famous mane of black hair had gone grey, and his prowess at arms had faded. North of the Blackwater, the Riverlands were ruled by the